This is 1A. I'm Joshua Johnson in Washington. The rap group Public Enemy once said that 911 is a joke, but these days, people are taking it very seriously. Statistics show that Americans place 240 million 911 calls every year for all kinds of reasons. But calling the police does not guarantee a quick or effective response. These situations can escalate, as they did recently at a Philadelphia Starbucks, a gym in New Jersey, and a Waffle House in Alabama. Now, sometimes it's just a simple misunderstanding. Other times, there can be deadly consequences.
Cleveland Police, Hollinger.
Hi, how are you? I'm sitting in the park at West Boulevard by the West Boulevard Rapid Transit Station. And there's a guy in there with a pistol. You know, it's probably fake, but he's like pointing it at everybody.
That was the 911 call before Tamir Rice was shot dead. And the caller was right. That pistol was just a toy, but the officers opened fire the moment they arrived. Tamir Rice was just 12 years old. What should we expect when we call 911? Is there a wrong time to call the cops for help? And how can we, as callers, get the results we want when we dial? We'll dig into these questions and more in just a moment.
It's time for the Pop Culture Happy Hour Summer Movie Preview. We're predicting hits and flops, telling you what we're looking forward to, and helping you spend that ticket money wisely. Available right now from Pop Culture Happy Hour.
Joining us from WUOT Public Radio in Knoxville is Thomas Self, a 911 dispatcher and advanced emergency medical technician in Knoxville, Tennessee. Thomas, welcome to 1A.
Thank you for having me.
What is your average work day like?
My average work day is I come in just a little bit early before my shift and get a report from the off-going dispatcher to, you know, tell me what's going on with the units, if there's anything I need to know about throughout the day, if any changes are supposed to happen. And I just go throughout my day. I can either be answering calls or dispatching units to emergencies. It just depends. We work on a rotation.
Walk me through how a 911 call works with you. Suppose I'm in Knoxville and I'm in a car crash, really nasty crash. I'm all right, but other people are hurt. I pick up the phone, dial 911, and I come through to you. Walk me through how the call works.
Well, the 911 call, whenever we receive it, we actually have 911 operators that answer the 911 lines, and we have dispatchers. You get routed to the 911 operator. They figure out what you need, what services you need based on the call, and then they build the call, and then they send it to the appropriate services so they can go ahead and get them in route.
I'm sorry, when you say they build the call, what does that mean?
You put it in the CAD. You build the call. You put notes in the computer-aided dispatch. And you send it to the proper, you can either send it to fire, EMS, police, and they see everything that the 911 operator is typing in through notes on their CAD.
So I call you for 911, there's an accident. I imagine that sometimes do you have to build multiple entries? Like say it's an accident with someone who I knew was trying to harm me by hitting me. Do you have to build one for police and one for EMS? Or do they all see it at once?
They all see it at once. You just send it to who it builds it as one call, and then you can click and see, okay, I want to send it to fire, EMS, and law enforcement. They all get the call at the exact same time.
And what's the difference between the operator and the dispatcher?
The operator takes the 911 calls when they come in to dispatch. The dispatchers, they don't call take at all. They don't answer the 911 lines. They answer the units, they go ahead and get them en route while the 911 operator is getting more information. That way they can have the units en route while more information is being obtained by the 911 operator.
How do they train people to do 911? If I was just starting out as an operator, first of all, if I'm going to be a 911 operator, I don't have to be a sworn law enforcement officer, right? That's a civilian job, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
Okay. What's the training like?
The training is they put you in to certain classes they got public telecommunicator that they go over certain things in there and teach you about, okay, you received this type of call, how to de-escalate the situation, because usually, shockingly, when people call 911, they're very calm. It's not frantic like most people think. They're actually there to give you the right information. And whenever they train you, they usually put you with somebody that's a veteran at it. And they usually teach you the ropes, like hands-on training, how to use the CAD, how to talk to the units. It's mostly just hands-on training and a lot of book work as well.
And I'm sorry, you said the CAD, that's computer-aided dispatch, is that it?
That is, yes.
I remember playing telephone as a little kid, and the point of the game is to realize how much can get lost when you share a message from person to person. How do you prevent information getting lost in translation from the operator to the dispatcher to the first responder?
Well, whenever the call gets sent over to the proper agency, if anything sounds weird or sounds off, there is a phone number in the CAD as well that we can do a callback. The 911 operator can do a callback, and we can get more information from the caller. So that kind of stops the loss of translation. It tries to. I mean, we're all human. We make mistakes. But we try to prevent that as much as we can.
What do you find in terms of the way that people use or perhaps misuse 911? I mean, we'll be talking more about these cases that made headlines momentarily, but how much do you find that people know or don't know what the appropriate use of your line really is?
It's a push and pull, really, because some of them know it's only for emergencies only, and some of them call us every day. We got what they're called frequent flyers. They call us every day with something new, something that they've already called for before, and it's pretty much just the abuse of the 911 system. It takes away resources from other people who really need it.
And when people do that, is there a recourse to deal with them? Can you ban them from 911 if necessary?
No. You can always call 911. I mean, if there is a life-threatening emergency, I always encourage, please call 911. But for the frequent flyers, we put them on the list and we get somebody out there. And if they call several times in a day, for at least Tennessee-wise, if they call several times in a day and they don't have an emergency, that is a arrestable offense.
Josh emailed, I think you need to step back from your emphasis in the intro that 911 is only for emergencies. In many areas, such as in Pittsburgh, where I live, the police and fire departments have disconnected their non-emergency numbers, and all calls, emergency and otherwise, must be placed through 911. Spreading the message that 911 is only for emergencies discourages people from reaching the police to report or get help with important matters that are not emergencies in nature. Thomas Self, could you react to that? I did not know that Pittsburgh has done that. I know that some cities and municipalities have added additional 1-1 numbers like 211 or 311 to divert other calls. What stood out to you from Josh's email about getting rid of those old non-emergency numbers?
Well, still here in Knoxville, we do have non-emergency numbers to call if it is not an emergency. We do get some 911 calls in that, they want to know information, and we try to help them as much as we can. Most of the time you just call if it's an emergency, but if it's not and they do call 911, I mean, we got several calls from people calling 911 just for a number for a taxi service. I mean, they range from different things every day.
And do you give it to them, or do you just say, I'm sorry, ma'am, that's 411, you'll have to call them?
It just depends on the dispatcher, really, if they wanted to or not. We have some dispatchers that say, okay, this is 911, you need to call a non-emergency line. And we got some dispatchers that, okay, well, they didn't know the number, so here it is.
Let's zoom out a little bit from the work in dispatch to some of the stories that have made headlines. Joining us from WHYY in Philadelphia is Aaron Haynes-Wack, a race and ethnicity reporter for the Associated Press. Aaron, welcome back to 1A.
Thanks so much for having me. Good to be back.
Let's talk about that 911 call from Philadelphia. Let's play a piece of the 911 call, and then I'll ask you to explain what happened.
Philadelphia Police, Operator 363. How may I help you?
Hi, I have two gentlemen at my cafe that are refusing to make a purchase or leave. I'm at the Starbucks at 18th and Spruce.
All right, police will be
be out as soon as possible.
Thank you.
Bye.
Erin, what happened?
Well, according to Rashawn Nelson and Dante Robinson, who I spoke with last week about this incident, the two of them arrive at the Starbucks in, you know, downtown Philadelphia about 10 minutes ahead of a scheduled meeting with another gentleman who was to meet them there. And, you know, initially Rashawn attempts to use the restroom, you know, ahead of the meeting, is told, you know, that it's the store's policy that unless he has bought something that he will not be able to use the restroom. He, you know, says fine, goes ahead to his seat. According to him, he and Dante, you know, are waiting for the third gentleman to arrive for the meeting to start. And the employee comes from behind the counter to ask them if they need help, if she can get them anything. They, you know, inform her, no, you know, we're waiting for a meeting. Within 10 minutes of their arrival, you know, the Philadelphia police show up at Starbucks. They think nothing of it because they're, again, doing what a lot of people do, waiting for their meeting to start at the Starbucks. But when the police approach them, they realize, you know, oh, you know, this person has called the police on us for waiting.
Erin, there's another story about an incident at a golf course that I'd like you to talk about. But before we get to that, a little clarification on the Starbucks story. Richard in Ann Arbor, Michigan asks, could we please have a more complete description of what went down at that Starbucks? Was there some sort of initial altercation? Did the two get a chance to explain that they were waiting for their friend to finish in the men's room? What attracted the manager's attention in the first place? Erin, do we know any of those details?
Well, from my reporting and my understanding and speaking with the two young men, what initiated it was Rashawn Nelson asking to use the restroom, you know, him not being a paying customer, and then, you know, the two of them sitting there waiting, still not having bought anything. But there was not an altercation. When the employee came over and asked if they needed any help, they said that they explained to her at that point that they were just there waiting for a meeting that was, you know, to start shortly. And, you know, when the police arrived, they said that there was, you know, they were not really asked very much about what was going on or why they were there. They were just told, you know, that they needed to leave. And they were, as they were trying to explain that they were waiting on, you know, the third gentleman, that person shows up, explains, you know, that he's there for a meeting, but they're let out in handcuffs by Philadelphia police.
And before we bring in our two other guests, can you tell us, Erin, about this incident at a golf course in Pennsylvania? What happened there?
Sure. So this happened in York, Pennsylvania, which is about 2 hours outside of Philadelphia. There were a group of women, black women golfers. They call themselves Sisters in the Fairway. And were out at the Grandview Golf Club, which they had become new members of a few months earlier. Weather finally, you know, gets good, and they decide that they're going to go, you know, out for an afternoon or morning afternoon of golf. And so they go to play golf. And not long after the game gets started, they are approached by an older white gentleman who tells them that they're playing too slowly and that they need to speed up. They say, you know, no, that's not the case. You know, our pace of play is fine. They try to continue on with the game. This person continues to tell them that they're going too slowly. And by, you know, the ninth hole, three of the women leave because they're you know, rattled by, you know, kind of this continued confrontation. The two women who are left are confronted a third time and told, according to them, because I interviewed them yesterday, told to get off the property and that the police had been called because they were refusing to leave. And the police did come, questioned, you know, both parties and did not end up arresting anyone. But basically because the women, because this gentleman felt that these women were playing too slowly, 911 had to respond at this golf course.
And who was that guy? Was he just another customer? Was he part of the staff of the golf course? Like, who was he?
So he turns out to be the father of one of the co-owners of the golf course.
Let's bring a few more voices into the conversation to react to that and all of your questions. Joining us from KJZZ Public Radio in Phoenix is Michael Wood, former Baltimore police officer and the author of Crimes and Punishments in the 21st Century. Michael Wood, welcome to the program.
Yeah, it's good to talk to you again.
And I beg your pardon, Michael Wood Jr., is it?
Oh, that doesn't matter, but yes.
Out of due respect to your father, Michael Wood Jr., thank you for being with us. And at WXXI in Rochester, New York, Cedric Alexander is the former police chief of the city of Rochester and of DeKalb County, Georgia. Today, he is Rochester's deputy mayor. Cedric, glad to have you with us.
Thank you for having me.
Michael, let me start with you. How much of what we've heard so far, particularly in terms of the experiences of dealing with emergency services, reflects what you've seen on the job? Michael?
Well, I think it's absolutely true. When it comes to policing, you're going to hear everything and do with everything because you are like the social wing of what the government services are. So you should be anticipating to face just about anything. But what I really see us getting caught up in is like the macros of these situations. And my expertise is in the systemic issues. And I would like to zoom out for 1 second to talk about that. And what I wanted to ensure is that I reviewed some of the latest peer-reviewed research. And the pattern still shows that essentially who calls 911 is dominated by Black communities. Now, there's a lot of layers to unpeel on that, but a quick paper that I read just called Police and Violence and Citizen Crime Reporting in the Black Community in the American Psychological Review states, in predominantly Black neighborhoods, publicized cases of police violence can have a community-wide impact on crime reporting that transcends individual encounters. So after big public incidents, crime reporting goes down, even when objective crime like murder goes up. Now, I believe this is reflected in historical Black communities because when other communities see police violence, they associate it with modern problems and individuals, while Black communities associate the violence with the long history of state violence on Black individuals, and rightfully so. But my concern is that this feedback loop that this reality creates, since crime is largely subjective and a measurement of police activity, after incidents of gross police misconduct, crime as it is measured goes down while violence goes up, and thus advocates for increased policing can say police cannot do anything about murder, which they cannot, but will point to the lowered crime reports as proof of effective policing, and the problems are problems of Black people being violent and needing more policing, and then that is directly how racism becomes institutionalized conventional wisdom, and you'll hear it from police chiefs, which I bet you're about to.
So I want to make sure, Michael, before we go to Cedric, that I take your point clearly. It sounds like what you're saying is that when one of these incidents comes up, like say what happened at the Starbucks in Philly or Tamir Rice, it kind of spooks communities of color and it reminds us of the issues we've had dealing with police over the years, which reduces the likelihood that people of color will call police at all. So on paper, it looks like there are fewer incidents, even though the incidence of crime does not change and it just becomes this vicious cycle. Am I hearing you right?
Absolutely. Gotcha. And to point out the martyrdom of Tamir Rice, that was the absolute emotional breaking point for me and transcended my life entirely to realize that we could do that and be that evil.
Cedric Alexander, how much of what we've heard so far about people's experiences with 911 resonated with you?
Well, first of all, let me just comment on what Michael just said. I certainly do agree with him. He stated that very eloquently to the listeners that are out there. And a part of the issue is, particularly in communities of color that oftentimes challenge with all the social ills that we all know permeate those communities, the perception of how police is utilized, how they come into those communities are going to be quite different than those oftentimes in majority communities. So it does come down to be somewhat subjective. It comes down to be what your experience and perception is of police. And it's also going to be rooted in a lot of history in those communities in which they have engaged police in the past. And one of the biggest challenges that policing is having today in America is that it has lost so much credibility in many communities. And I would go as far to say not just in communities of color, but a variety of different communities across this country. And it's trying to maintain your credibility and your legitimacy so that when people call police, they feel they're going to be treated in some type of way in which is going to be fair, it's going to be transparent, and it's going to be constitutional in nature. But when you have an incident that occurs that raises a great deal of questions, such as what we just saw in Philadelphia, what you just heard about on the golf course there in the state of Pennsylvania. Every step forward, one step forward, oftentimes policing end up, as we try to advance policing, I should say, something comes along that just pushes us back further than where we were when we started.
Thomas Self, how do you train dispatchers, or rather, how are dispatchers trained to deal with some of these cultural aspects that come up with 911 calls? I mean, it's not lost on us that the cases we've heard about recently involved black people. And not all of the issues with 911 are along lines of race. We've gotten a number of stories from listeners that have an array of different experiences with 911, good and bad, and the bad experiences are bad for a variety of reasons. But you can't deny the impact of race on law enforcement. How do you find dispatchers are trained to deal with that? Or are they?
They're really not. I mean, when you call 911, you're treated as a person whenever you call. You're just a voice. We can't see you. We don't know what you look like, what the color of your skin is. We help everyone that calls 911. We try to send them the best service that we can possible.
Well, but you can kind of infer some things about people the way they call. I mean, people, for example, people might not be able to tell what I look like from the way that I sound, but I'm African American. But if I change the way I talk, right, if I call 911 with a slightly different dialect, you know what I'm saying? Like, you might be able to tell what I look like, right? If I tell you I'm calling from Connecticut and Windsor and something happened and it was just a car accident and, like, you got to send somebody right away, instantly it paints a different picture. There are biases in the voice. Shouldn't people be trained to kind of check their own biases when they're providing help?
You put me on the spot on that one.
That's okay. I mean, I think that's fine. But I think this is part of the issue. And Aaron, I don't know if this came up at all in your reporting on that 911 process, but we do make first impressions based on the voice. I mean, I've had people tell me they thought I was a little Jewish white dude based on the way I sounded on the radio. And then they meet me in person, they're like, oh, damn, I was wrong. So we think about people based on the way they sound. How much of that came up in your reporting?
Well, not much in terms of in terms of that particular point, but I do want to go back to something that Mr. Self said that I think is really important, and that is that most people who call 911 are calm. And I think that that would probably be something that would be surprising to a lot of people. I think back to one of the articles that I read, you know, in the wake of the Starbucks incident, was noting, you know, just kind of the tone of the Starbucks employee when she called the police on these two young men. Just sounded very calm, you know, and you know, almost casual in her request for police assistance, you know, whereas, you know, that is something that probably would have been alarming, you know, to those two young men had they known that she was making that phone call in that moment.
Some of you have had to deal with some of these very distinct cultural nuances within the 911 system. OK Peregrino tweeted, in the 1980s, I worked in an ambulance dispatch center for 911. Dispatchers must interpret cultural references, coordinate response vehicles, and understand speech differences, sometimes doing this from the bathroom. We are trained, dedicated, but not supermen. We make mistakes. I know we have to pause momentarily, but Michael, I wonder what you think would be a way forward through some of these cultural challenges, even just knowing maybe what neighborhood a call comes from and knowing who lives there and what people there look like and how affluent or not affluent it is. I know we have to pause, but what might be a step in the right direction to dealing with that?
Well, basically, I feel like the responsibility needs to be on law enforcement and the leaders of government, not looking at the people for what they should be doing. But I really think there is a relatively simple answer here. And we're all caught up in premises that are false. We all call 911 to call in violence as a solution. Police are violence. And that is rooted in two scientifically false assumptions, that violence or punishment is an effective deterrent, which it is not, hands down, and that race is even real. Race is not real. So when you say something like, how does race impact a situation? It doesn't. It cannot. It's not real. Racism is real. So racism and bias can affect things. But that's for us with power to address and eliminate our biases, not act like the public has to cater to our ineptitude. And we shouldn't be advancing policing. We should be regressing policing.
And when you say, I just want to make sure we're clear. When you say race is not real, you mean it's just a social construct. It's not something that's inherent to us in our DNA.
Yeah, it's absolutely not in DNA at all. Nowhere in scientific literature will any legit researcher point to race as anything. It is a terrible way that we categorize in other people. And as long as we continue to other people, we will continue to have our biases up.
I do want to hear from Cedric Alexander about what we can do with biases as well and talk more about the way that race affects policing and 911 as we continue our conversation with Thomas Self, Aaron Haynes-Wack, Cedric Alexander, and Michael Wood Jr. What should we do when it comes time to call 911? Is there ever a time not to call, even when you want to? Stay close.
Support for NPR and the following message come from the NPR Wine Club. Discover hand-selected wines from award-winning vineyards around the world. Learn the stories behind each one and enjoy unique bottles inspired by your favorite NPR shows, like Weekend Edition. All with the convenience of home delivery. A special welcome offer includes a bottle of Weekend Edition Cabernet Sauvignon. If you're 21 years or older, join in the fun at nprwineclub.org/1A.
What's unique about the human experience, and what do we all have in common? I'm Guy Raz. Every week on TED Radio Hour, we go on a journey through the big ideas, emotions, and discoveries that fill all of us with wonder. Find it on NPR One or wherever you get your podcasts.
Cedric, let me give you a chance to chime in, and then we'll get to some more listener comments.
Let me just say this, is that one of the things that I'm concerned about, of course, in this country is that the issue was raised pretty much about how do 911 operators, those that the public is going to interact with anytime that they need police or emergency service. And 911 operators and dispatchers and those that are going to confront, interface, or communicate with the public through telephone, whatever technology, they themselves have to be persons who have been adequately identified as being individuals that are capable of being able to set their own biases aside. People who call into police should not have to be required to use a certain type of language or to be able to present themselves in a way in which is conducive to that of the operators or the police. They're citizens. The government work for the people. The people don't work for the government. And as just Michael had alluded to a few moments ago, it becomes important then that we recruit and we train and we make it very consciously evident to those that go into this profession that regardless of who calls in, is that we manage people the same. That's the same thing we say about policing and any other emergency type job that people may be employed by. But the community also has a responsibility to partner with the police departments in their respective communities. But I think it's very important that we be clear about the fact that police and emergency management is there to serve the public and to meet them wherever they are. So government has a responsibility to make sure that it trains and recruit the right people for that job. And it's one other thing I just want to say about this whole Starbucks piece is that when we look at what happened in the reports that we receive, the question I have for Starbucks, what's their policy around people coming into their stores? Because I heard from the president, and I think we all did, the president or the CEO of Starbucks, who stated that people are welcome to come in, sit down, hook up to their Wi-Fi, and not necessarily purchase anything. So how did this manager interpret that policy? And what was her reason or discretion, or was she just given too much discretion as to determine who gets called, when does she get to call the police? So I think Starbucks here are going to have to answer some policy questions. Because if they're training their managers, the fact that people can come in and have a seat and don't have to purchase anything, then if that's going to be your policy, then let that be your policy. But I'm going to tell you, you're right. That was a high-end part of the community in Philadelphia. But what about in other communities? It's a much more challenge where you may have vagrants, you may have people on drugs, you may have people with mental health issues that come into your store and camp out there and go into your bathroom and lock themselves into it. Starbucks can't have it both ways either. So they need to they need to be clear about what their policy is and be able to train their managers in a much better way that's going to be consistent to the policy and to the laws of whatever state they're in.
I do want to get to a few more listener comments, but Cedric, before we move on, speaking of policy, I presume the police did not have to make an arrest simply because they were called. That situation could have ended in a variety of different ways, including not with arresting.
Here's a double-edged sword to that. You call me to your place of business or to your home. And under most state laws in most states, if you don't want anyone on your property, you can ask them to leave. If they refuse to leave, they certainly can be subject to arrest. In this case, you're absolutely right. The police could have interviewed both sides, the managers and the gentlemen that were involved. The gentlemen were very calm. They were very respectful. It is clear, from what I understand, officers were pretty professional. But they had the discretion, yes, to arrest or not to arrest. But here's the problem. Had the officers say, hey, we're not going to arrest these gentlemen, they're not doing anything, then now you have Starbucks that come back, make complaint against the police department for not doing their job. It's a double-edged sword here, and we can't have it both ways. If we're going to call police to come out and act professionally and enforce the law, then we also have to make sure that these establishments have policies and practices that are going to be consistent, because those gentlemen certainly should not have been arrested.
We also did.
However, we put law enforcement in the line of these attacks oftentimes, and then they end up being the bad guys to it all.
Julie wrote on our Facebook page, these people, the manager at Starbucks, the manager of the golf course, used 911 to intimidate and convey the message, you don't belong. On the one hand, it's so disgusting and shameful. On the other hand, we can't fix a problem without it being exposed. These hateful people have nowhere to hide now when they claim to be victims. They are not. They are the oppressors. We are all human beings. No one is better than the other. We must not allow hate and intolerance to win. Michael, I wonder what your thoughts are on Julie's comment, particularly because I would guess that the manager at Starbucks did not think of herself as a hateful, oppressive person. She probably just thought on some level that she was just following policy. Yes, she may have had implicit biases, but I'm pretty sure she would be stunned to hear herself described as hateful. You know, if there's a problem, you call 911 and let the police deal with it. That's the way the system is supposed to work.
Yeah, I would totally agree with you. I feel like, I mean, on the surface, it looks like that she would do what the most people would do. And we're told to let the police handle it, don't get involved, to stay back. And those are all normal things. But look at what everyone is saying here. They're calling for policing as more violence. Cedric is seriously talking about not only enforcing the law, but stepping into private companies and enforcing what they say. This is on us as the police. It is not on these things. You are no less a servant to the suspect than the 911 caller. It's a really baffling idea to me. We keep getting stuck in that violence is some answer, and that is not at all what reality or what science tells us.
Well, wait a minute. That's not what I heard Cedric say. I heard Cedric say that Starbucks needs to clarify its policy on when you are and are not allowed to stay, particularly because there are Starbucks in a variety of places of different socioeconomics. And I also heard Cedric describe the tension that an officer on the scene could face based on the fact that they have this matrix of options. They could just try to talk the situation down. They could make an arrest. They could open fire. They could respond with force. There's all kinds of things that could happen, and the officer has to make a smart decision. I think you and I heard Cedric say two different things.
I don't understand how the company policy of Starbucks is relevant to the policies and practices of law enforcement.
Well, if Starbucks' policy is you are not allowed to stay here unless you pay for something, nationally, period, full stop, then it makes a little more sense to call. But if the policy is, hey, we're just a third place for people, they spend time at work, home, and Starbucks, and you have your discretion, then that changes the thought process of a Starbucks associate to call 911 just because someone's sitting and not ordering, as opposed to saying, hey, that's part of what Starbucks is for. They can hang out. Maybe they'll order something later. So I kind of get
that.
I
don't know, man. Like, using policy as a determinant of whether you're going to do the multi-complex array of social interactions doesn't really make sense to me. We have police to get up there and to mitigate the situation on hand and to do the best thing for society, not to go in there and enforce something. There is not necessarily a wrong person because a 911 call was made.
Thomas, I know our time is running out, but what would you say is the one thing you wish more people would bear in mind before they pick up the phone to call 911?
That 911, it's not just like a regular phone line. I believe it is for emergencies only, and I would say that use it correctly. Use it the way you can.
Cedric,
the right way.
I know we're wrapping up, but Cedric, what about you? What would you say is the one thing you wish more people would bear in mind before they call 911, briefly?
Well, I think it becomes incumbent upon government to make sure that in each one of our communities that we train people around the usage of 911, how that differentiates from 311 or 211. And because certainly we want people to be able to utilize a 911 system.
311 for municipal services, 211 for social services.
Or whatever it may happen to be in your particular community. And now, I think the other important piece is that when it comes to 911 operators and dispatchers and those that are in the helping profession, such as the gentleman you have there from Knoxville, they are committed, they're hardworking, they train well. And we just all have to be very socially conscious that we serve a great deal of number of different types of people in this country and in communities across this country.
Before we're out of time, I'm sorry, Cedric, I want to give Michael one more chance to respond. Briefly, what's the one thing you wish more people would bear in mind before they call 911? Briefly.
Police are not your partners. They are servants. And we need to make laws and policy that makes us actual part of actual servants and not the concept of partners, which we are, which is doing things like saying we can educate the public. And it's not like our job to tell the public what to be or to handle 911 differently. It is our job to serve.
Michael Wood, former Baltimore police officer and the author of Crimes and Punishments in the 21st Century. Cedric Alexander, the deputy mayor of Rochester, New York. Associated Press race and ethnicity reporter Aaron Haynes-Wack. And Thomas Self, a 911 dispatcher based in Knoxville, Tennessee. Thank you all for being with us. I'm Joshua Johnson. Thank you very much for listening. This is 1A.